Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, tennis fans from around the globe. The following program is a presentation of the Yellow Ball Network.
Oh, what a shot!
Are we on?
Yep, we're on.
All right, let's go.
Broadcasting live from the Tennis Dynamics Studio in downtown Marietta, Georgia, this is the We Coach Tennis Radio Show on the Yellow Ball Network. Your host for the show this week is J.P. Weber.
Everybody, welcome back to another edition of the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. It's live radio. You've probably been sitting there. Well, I haven't been back here in quite some time, but you've probably been sitting there wondering where I was. well, it's a miracle I'm even here. I've been dealing with some medical stuff. Diagnosed lately with diabetes, so I had a doctor's appointment earlier. I had doctor's appointments all the time now. Everywhere I go, I got another doctor's appointment about this stuff. If you're any, I guess there's a lot of people in the U.S. facing this. So if you're getting close to facing this, don't do it. It's not worth it. I'm driving in here. It's live radio. I'm sorry I'm late. We got here just as soon as we could. We're going to try to go to commercial. We come back. This is the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. I am J.P. Weber. The hotline number to call is 646-652-4856. Hopefully, we're going to get on here. And I pre-recorded a interview with Chet Murphy. Great Chet Murphy. And let me do some commercials. We're going to come right back and get on the show. We Coach Tennis Radio Show. Live radio. Can't see. Can't hardly speak. Everything. But we're going to get it done. Bye.
Come play the Marietta Grand Prix. It's a lot of fun. You get to play a lot of tennis, and we have Chick-fil-A sandwiches from Chick-fil-A. And you get to eat a lot. And if you can, you can play doubles with your friends or with your dad or your mom.
Hey, folks. This is J.P. Weber. Take it from the kid. The 2015 Handmade Charlotte Marietta Grand Prix Series of Tournaments is a great way to spend the day with the family playing tennis. To find out more, go to www.tennisdynamics.net. That's tennisdynamics.net, where you can call us at the Laurel Park Tennis Center at 770-919-8602. Hi, coaches and players. If you play on a tennis court in the Southeast, you've probably played on a tennis court designed, constructed, lighted, or resurfaced by courtmakers.com. Marshall Dye and the guys at Courtmakers will work on any type of court. From my experience with them, they work in a professional manner, they show up on time like they say they will, and they never leave a mess. Courtmakers can provide for all equipment needs. Call them at 770-795-8400. 770-795-8400. That's courtmakers.com.
Hi, this is Coach Chuck Creasy. I take great pride in calling it the way it is. It's a meat and potato principle of coaching that no one really cares what you know unless they know that you care. As a parent also, I want this and very skilled hands working with my youngster. Coach J.P. Weber's 30 years of experience speaks for itself. Go see him at Laurel Park in Marietta, Georgia. His website is TennisDynamics.net. TennisDynamics.net.
Okay, we're back. I got a chance a few, I found out about 3 or 4 months ago from Bill Wright, the former head coach at Cal Berkeley and the head coach at Arizona, that a friend of his, Chet Murphy, had moved here to the Atlanta area, south of Atlanta, down near Alabama. So I did the best I could. We're going to have a little extracurricular stuff there. Everything happens in live radio. You know, I don't have a commercial. I don't have staff. Staff? There's no staff here today to help me with this one. So, anyway, so Chet Murphy moved here. He's close to the Alabama border and down toward Noonan, Georgia. So we went down there, and it's not too far from Atlanta. I met with him and had an interview with him. Chet wrote quite a few books. Tennis for the Thinking Players was one of his. And he wrote that sort of, he says in the thing, in response to, I can't think of the guy. I'm going to get Coach Creasy on here in a second. The Inner Game of Tennis, I think, where you don't think about tennis. So Chet wrote something about thinking about tennis. He wrote A Lifetime Treasury of Tested Tips, Secrets of Winning Play. One of his best books was The Tennis Handbook of Drills. He also wrote Tennis for Beginners. And I was actually particularly interested in a book he wrote, How to Teach Your Child to Play Baseball, Football, Soccer, Basketball, Tennis, Tumbling, and Volleyball. So I've got Coach Creasy on the line here, hopefully. Coach, are you there?
Hey, good morning, JP. It's always good to talk to you. And
well, I don't have many days left. I don't have many days left to talk anymore. My days are numbered.
All of us are, if we can only live that way. Understand that.
Well, the USTA will be glad when this radio show goes away, I guess. But anyway, so back to the deal here with Chet Murphy. He quite a prodigious writer. He's in his 90s, and he lived quite a bit of tennis and did a career and retired and started another career. He's been did you follow him much?
You know, of course, all of us did. I mean, back in the days when we started picking up tennis in the 60s, there wasn't a lot of information out there, and it was hard to get. We would hang on to and literally read every word we could find in a Sports Illustrated, maybe now and then. World Tennis, of course, was the only book magazine back there, the publication that gave any information. Chet Murphy, his books, and his brother Bill, I mean, they were the authors. They were the people that you went to and got so many information. Their book of drills, and I think they had 6 or 7 books out. He did, but he was an educator. That's the biggest thing that you need to remember about him. If he was an educator, he was the kind of person. He ended up getting his PhD. He taught for years. He coached just about at every level, but he was a writer also. Educators want to get their ideas out there in a way that's going to help the cause of growing the game everywhere. You know, nowadays, getting information is like drinking water out of a fire hose with the internet. It's not the fact that we don't have the information. It's the fact that no one knows what water to drink out of that fire hose, JP. Back in those days, boy, did we hang on to any information because we couldn't get it. Most players were self-taught, and most players would, you found a lot of unique things in tennis, people being self-taught and different strokes. But Chet Murphy, my golly, he was born in 1917, JP. That would make him, he's 98 years old. I mean, that he was born in 1917.
Everybody will hear in the interview, he served in World War II as a pilot, and he had a very interesting life. It's almost something that maybe somebody could put together a film or a documentary on. He's a very interesting gentleman. Let me speak to one thing you mentioned there. You know, you mentioned, and I hear this often from you, we have sort of a fire hose of information that we get to pull from these days, and a lot of it's junk. it was tougher to get the junk out there in that day. They didn't just publish junk. You had to get through quite a bit of stuff. And there's a difference in the way that we see and get information. Like you said, I think it was, you know, maybe you could speak to that a little bit more. When things came out, it wasn't quite as often, and it wasn't quite as frequent. And so you would, you know, if you had a good book that came out or something of that nature, you'd read it from cover to cover.
Exactly. You're exactly right, JP. Information was such a prized thing. You would read a tennis book from cover to cover, and you would just wait till the next World Tennis Magazine came out. And if the pros came to town, I remember I grew up in Indianapolis, and when the pros came to town once a summer at this club up on the west side of town, oh, my golly, we would go out there, and we could not wait to see how they hit the ball. How did they do this? What were they doing? And does that look like your grip that you're using or my grip that I'm using? And we would hang on everything and watch and try to learn by watching. But the hunger for the sport was a beautiful thing. Now, the analogy, as you know, I always use is that now with the glut of information that we have, no one knows the difference between diamonds or rhinestones. And the analogy I will often use, and I got this from Coach Tom Simpson, who used to live in Africa. He said some of the children in South Africa, when they don't recognize a crude and uncut diamond, you will find kids playing marbles with diamonds. They think they're rocks. And, of course, many people think that rhinestones and flash are diamonds. And so this is a tragedy that no one understands the difference between diamonds or rhinestones anymore. And this man is somebody who should be revered. About 25 years ago, Clarence Mabry and a few other coaches from the TBRM down there in Texas tried to get baseball card type tennis cards put out of all the great people in the history of tennis. They believe that our youngsters did not know enough about the game, the history of the game, and those people who really were noteworthy. But this Chet and Bill Murphy were extremely noteworthy, and my golly, it's a tragedy that our young players come up, do not honor the game. If they honored the game more, if we went for a little bit more of the deep things in the game instead of the flash. We're trying to be entertainers instead of educators, and I don't want to go off on that tangent today, but basically it's a tragedy that most of them don't know who Chet Murphy is, and nor his brother, his twin brother Bill. Golly, they were state high school champions, NCAA finalists, doubles players. They went on, but the greatest contribution was the teaching and their books, and their posterity is great regardless of what their prosperity was. So, but it's a tragedy we don't honor. And I'm glad that you're doing shows on some of the great people in the history of our game here in the United States, JP.
Well, I want to try. If you've got anybody else that you know of that's out there that needs to be recognized as a coach, I'd like to do that. That's what the We Coach Tennis show is about. You know, I thumbed through quite a bit of his stuff. I went and ordered nearly all of his books. One guy got me. One guy, you know, you order this stuff online, and one guy got me for whatever it was, the cost of the book. I never got his book, but most of the books I got, I thumbed through them. There's a lot of truisms in them. There's a lot of stuff that's out there, like you said now, but I think we scrambled the kids' brains now. Kids have more trouble to get, brains get scrambled on the court. It should be quiet. You have a saying, loud body, is it loud body, quiet mind?
Loud bodies and quiet mind is how
loud body, quiet mind. It's hard to have a loud body and quiet mind now with all that information pumping through these guys.
the diamonds and rhinestones, you want to hear, and I won't, just want to give you a real quick story. But one of my last years at Clemson, JP, I asked the golf coach, Larry Penley at Clemson, you have this sports psychologist seems to be helping you a lot. And he told me about a guy down in, I guess it's all right, Morris Pickens down in Columbia, South Carolina. and I got Morris to come out to do a little bit of a seminar with our guys. And I can remember some of the guys poo-pooing it, you know, well, we've heard this stuff before, we heard this stuff before. And do you know that about, 4 or 5 months later, I had to sit the guys down and I said, any of you guys know who won the Masters? And it was Zach. I'm sorry, I forgot the name. But anyhow, he won the Masters. Come on, he finished ninth this time, and that's where I'm at. I can't remember names anymore. But Zach won the Masters, and he credited. He said, "Yeah, I'd like to thank my mental coach, Morris Pickens." And I went to the practice guys. I said, "Guys, do you remember this guy?" And they said, "Coach, and that guy." He said, "No, he just helped guy win the Masters here last week, and you guys didn't even see the diamond right in front of you. You know, you didn't even see the diamond." And we do that all the time. I use the example of the greatest violinist. Who is the guy? Let's see that. This great violinist from the New York Philharmonic. He went.
Isaac Perlman.
Yeah. Isaac Perlman. That's right. He went and he sat down in Grand Central Station and acted like a bum, and he played his best pieces and tin can out in front or cup, and people would just walk by, and he played half a day there, and nobody recognized him, and a couple people stopped and say, that guy ain't bad. He's the greatest violinist in the world, but it's tragic that nobody sees diamonds or rhinestones, and it's just absolutely, you know, tragic that we really don't. And it's just where kids are. It's just where people are in our society. It's so shallow, isn't it? It's just terrible. You know.
Well, this guy's, I was particularly, and if I can get a chance to go back, he's in his 90s, Coach. You know, God, I wish that I'm in the shape that he's in his 90s. It was a little bit difficult to listen. I hope the
Zach Johnson. Isn't that terrible? Isn't that terrible? I couldn't. Sorry. Sorry out there, you golfers. But go ahead. He's 98, JP. He's born in 1917. Do you know what he's seen in his lifetime?
Exactly.
It's incredible. So we're all looking forward to the interview, but thanks for letting me say a few things. And again, diamonds or rhinestones, we don't know the difference. That's going to be the tragedy of our American society. It's a tragedy in tennis right now. And if you know where I'm coming from, I always argue that we're pushing entertainment, and shame on us for bastardizing our sport and dumbing it down to go for the entertainment value. We need to go for the education. We need to try to build the diamonds, not the rhinestones, that sustain our heart. The game needs to sustain our heart. But this is one of the guys that did. I'm looking forward to the interview. Thank you for doing the interview, JP.
Well, I'm looking forward to getting on here. Hopefully in a second, I've got one more call. If you can stay on here with me for a second, Coach Creasy.
Sure.
I hope that Coach Bill Wright will call in. I've been texting him, and I'm hoping he's going to call in as well. He's a good friend of Chet Murphy's, and I sent him a text, and hopefully he's going to call at the – if he's listening to the show, I wish he would call the 646-652-4856 number. The 646-652-4856 number. And I'm hoping that he'll be able to call that here in a second. And I wanted to do that just real quick. Bill, Chet was at the Bardmore in Colorado. He was at Cal Berkeley. He coached at University of Chicago, I believe. He coached, I think, at Detroit Mercy. He was all over. He was in Tucson for a while, and I keep getting extra calls. I'm going to go ahead and I can't quite get it to work right. So what I'm going to do is go ahead and Coach, I appreciate you talking, And I'll go ahead and start playing. I know people are probably listening. They don't want to hear me, and they hear enough of you every week. So I'm going to go ahead.
I love the game. I love the game, and I love the things that sustain you about the game. The flash will blow away, you know, faster than anything, you know.
All right. I'm going to try and get this interview started, or get the first part. This will be the first part of the interview, and I spent some time with him. And hold on, I think we do have Coach Wright. Are you there?
Yes, I am, JP.
Coach Wright, I'm getting ready to air my. You've known Chet Murphy for quite some time, and I'm getting ready. I just wanted to make sure to bring people up to speed. I got Coach Creasy on the line here. The guy has lived a long life. I got to, based on your recommendation, I got to go down and to interview him. Can you say a few things about him, just to give some of the people some background on him?
Did he pass away?
Oh no, sir. I hope not. No, I'm just kidding. Now I'm probably gonna pass away before he does.
I know it. I know we all are. We all are. He is one of the most interesting guys around in tennis, JP. I've known him since I was 10 years old, and I've always been a huge fan of his. He has a very wry sense of humor. He is a tennis absolute wacko, and he's just a wonderful guy. He got kind of misplaced there in the college coaching ranks at the time he went in. He was coaching in the 70s, and at Berkeley there was a lot of hair and a lot of pot and a lot of shenanigans going on, and he was in the middle of that, and he didn't react to that real well. That was very hard on him. So he got out of college coaching, and he'd been a very, very successful one, and he was a very good coach, very conscientious, very
Hopefully, he coached several different places. Hopefully, he is, guys. Both of you guys are Hall of Famers for the ITA. We have a symphony conductor who's now going to be in the ITA. Hopefully, Chet Murphy is in the ITA's Hall of Fame. Is he, guys?
He's not a music conductor. Okay.
Right. He's not a music conductor. He sings along, but he doesn't play any instruments.
All right, guys. I appreciate y'all calling in. Let me go ahead and let everybody's wanting to listen to Coach Murphy and then Coach Wright or Coach Creasy. This is the first part. I'd love if y'all happen to listen to it or hear any of his stories. He's got some pretty good stories in here. I did a little editing. Like you said, Coach Wright, he's got a good sense of humor, so I had to edit a couple of things a little bit, old school humor. So, but at any rate, what we'll do is I'll play this, and then maybe before the next one we can talk again. I can revisit him with you guys and hopefully bring him. I like the idea of what I'm doing here with this show, of bringing guys like Chet Murphy to light. And if you guys know of anybody else that's listening, if you know of anybody else that I'm missing in these interviews, point them to me. All right, guys, thanks for calling.
So JP?
Yes, sir.
Did you say I had old-time humor, or was that Chuck?
I think all of y'all do.
Okay. All right. Talk to you later.
All right, I'm gonna play his interview. Here we go.
Tell me, so you grew up in Chicago?
South side of Chicago, yeah.
And
where they're having all the trouble.
Where they're having all the trouble?
Public Park.
How did you get, did you start tennis through a public park?
Yeah, I have an interesting story about how I got into the game. A lot of people say, as a tennis pro, I've asked, you know, even my age now, how did you get in the game? Everybody said, well, let me tell you what happened. My brother and I were in a public high school in Chicago, Tilden Technical High School, no girls. And we played everything. We lived across the street from a park, McKinley Park, a public park. Had the world's worst tennis courts. In fact, the nets were hardly ever up they didn't care two hoots in hell about them. But we played everything else. At a nice little gym, we played basketball, played softball, and not tennis. But one day I was sitting in study hall, and I looked up in front and I saw that, gee, the study hall teacher is that Mr. Parkhill, who is teaches the kids to play tennis. And so I just sat there, and I noticed that he looked up and he looked, oh my gosh, he's recognizing me as a participant at the McKinley Park, the public park that had the world's worst tennis courts and no tennis program. I forgot to mention, didn't have a tennis program. But he recognized me as a habitué of the park. And I said, by God, he's coming down the aisle. And he walked down the aisle to me, and he looked and he said, hey, are you one of the twins from McKinley Park? I said, yeah. He said, you play tennis? I said, no. You want to learn to play? I said, no. He threw at me, literally threw at my desk, what was in American Lawn Tennis, ALT, the tennis magazine. Here, twin, read this. So then he went back to the front of the class, and I thumbed through this, and I said, what a strange sport. Here are these guys, men running around in funny little white pants. And the woman had turned the pages, and there's some women, and they look like they're dressed to go to the senior prom and not play tennis. What the kind of sport is this, last night? And pretty soon he came back to me. He said, you don't play tennis? I said, no. He said, you want to learn to play? I said, no. He said, oh, let's see. Well, by God, next thing I know, at home, we lived across the street from the park. Got home about 2 days later, and my dad said, hey, one of your teachers came over. Anyway, to make a long story short, Bill Parker went to our house and talked to our mother and dad and said he wanted to teach us to play tennis. He had a rank in this city, player and stuff. And so our dad said, can't do that. We only have one basketball. And he has to go to work at the same time we go to school. Well, somebody's got to change the schedule. So they changed our schedule. We got up early and went to Tilden High School because he was teaching at his own prerogative, let's say, on the Wooden High School basketball floor in the morning before school. And then all day Saturday. Let's go. Bill, my brother and I said, okay, let's go. So we went to Tilden High School early one morning, and he showed us how to hold a racket, how to do this and how to do that. And his good player was a nice fellow who accepted Bill and me and made us feel at home with the other six or eight players. Well, that guy became a father,
Father figure.
But there's a technical word. And he taught Bill and me to play from the moment you hold it like this, and you stand like that, and you swing like this. And we owed him a great deal of debt for it.
Do you remember his name?
Bill Parkhill.
Bill Parkhill.
He went to Oberlin. He went to Oberlin as a youngster. Played football at Oberlin, and his claim to fame, he drop kicked, and drop kicked, beat Ohio State for Oberlin College at the draw. But he liked tennis.
Now, how did a guy back in the tennis has always sort of had a
nothing. I should have told the kind of neighborhood we were in. Man, we used to hide the racket under our jacket because kids would make fun of us till we got to the sanctuary of the park.
Oh, my God.
Walking down the street because, hey, it's turning 40 love. They'd see us. Bill and I would cross the street to go in a different direction in Game Cross Street. And all of a sudden we'd hear, 40 love. That's the worst thing I could say. But we liked it. We just stayed with it, you know. And one thing I'd turn.
But you were good athletes.
We were for yes, we
you
were.
You played basketball as well.
Yeah, we played. We could have gone to Notre Dame. I tell you, we could have gone to Notre Dame to play basketball. We chose not to. We went to Chicago. But I got off the track there. Oh, our neighborhood was far from being classy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's why tennis was a joke.
What part of Chicago was it? Do you remember?
It's the south side of Chicago.
South side. Yeah,
back of the yards. Back of the yards.
Back of the
stockyards.
Yeah. Back of the stockyards.
Our dad would walk to work. We were that close to. Our dad would walk to the stockyards and work and then come back. And we didn't have a car. But so this coach Bill Parkhill became proctor father to Bill and me. And he taught us, we hit the ball flat, and it's essentially a baseline game.
You you went on to play at the University of Chicago. Did both of you play together at Chicago?
Yeah.
You won the Big Ten? Or
we won the Big Ten. I was Big Ten champ twice. I played one every year. We won the doubles twice in the Big Ten.
Northwestern was in that conference.
Yeah, Northwestern. Everybody, the regular Big Ten.
Who were the good players in the conference? Do you remember?
No. There were two brothers on our team, the Chosums. Northwestern had a guy named Marvin something from Milwaukee. And I think a year or two later, I think Notre Dame, this guy became a ranking player, who then became a writer, a tennis writer, and wrote some tennis articles. But the national, we were, collegiate tennis was no tennis at all.
It wasn't.
I mean,
what was the format then? How did you, was it singular,
same,
was it individual, or tennis?
Same as now, six singles. No, it's different from now, it's so different. Then it was six singles that went on at the same time, and then the doubles afterward, and the same singles guys could play doubles if they needed, or they could have a new doubles team.
Uh-huh.
And the match was a nine, best out of nine, see.
Did you have, you know, Jimmy Everett, I think,
yes, Jimmy Everett.
To Notre Dame, right?
Yeah, he did. Jimmy Everett lived the other side of town. We never played him. We were, Bill and I think, were 2 years older than Jimmy Everett. And so our paths never crossed in junior. Junior was 16 and under then, you know. Used to be, did you know that you used to have boys tennis 15 and under, and then also had 17 and under.
Was Kalamazoo still going on?
Kalamazoo had the tournament. No, they didn't. They didn't have the big junior tournaments were played at Culver Military Academy in Indiana, and then the next week at St. John's Military Academy in Wisconsin. And Kalamazoo was not in existence these years that we were in high school.
Uh-huh.
And then I think we went to Tilden Tech High School, not the Tilden, not the player's name. He was a meat packer. Mr. Tilden was a meat packer. They named the high school after him.
Well, so after you went to college, you then got into, did you get into, what did you do after college?
Well, let me tell you what an incident first.
Well, and actually, let me back up even more. Tell me the incident. Do you mind telling me the incident or the encounter you had with Bitsy Grant again one more time?
Well, yeah, we just played. I was a little guy, about my second, maybe my second year under Mr. Parker. I didn't know much except what he taught me, and Bitsy. It was I'm surely seated somewhere in the. This was the National Clay Court Tournament, River Forest Tennis Club. River Forest is a classy suburb of Chicago, country club style, you know. And so we played. By that time, we had played for 2 years in our public park. I remember my mother made shorts for me, put a yellow stripe here, and people it was just then going from.
Long pants to shorts.
And the match was written up a bit because, as I said, I had beaten somebody in the earlier on, but I didn't know. He just killed me, and I never been so tired in my sports life. You know, I thought I'm gonna burst. I thought, man, because he ran the hell out of me. I didn't belong on the court, but that's the extent of how we started.
So you and your brother played in high school together, then played college tennis together at Chicago. What did you guys do? You wrote, between the two of you, you wrote numerous books. What happened after, so you did that together, what happened after college tennis?
Yeah, okay. We graduated in 1939. The war was 1941. Well, after we graduated, 39, and so I won the Big Ten championship, and together he and I won the doubles. And we decided to go to graduate school, which we did. We went to a small college on the Chicago South Side, George Williams College. It was kind of a YMCA school. A guy named George Williams in Europe founded the YMCA, I've been told. And so here our school was the YMCA. We loved it. Athletic school and stuff. 2 years. And it was the 2 years after we graduated. We graduated from Chicago in 39. And in 40 and 41, we went to George Williams College. Then on 41, December 41, that Japanese dropped the bomb. War came. War. And instead of thinking about forehands and backhands, we were wondering about landing speed, takeoff, we were flyers. Hardly ever play. Except that, I should have told you. At that time, the best players in our states that were going to Forest Hills to play didn't fly over you. Nobody flew over you. You just hopped. Alice Marble was the world's best women's player, and she was going from L.A. to Denver to Chicago and to New York. Well, in Chicago, they stopped at the Chicago Tennis Association, stopped her and arranged for her and I to play an exhibition right there in our university courts. And we had a great time. That's just where she fell down. We had gritty, good clay courts, nice courts. And she fell down, and there's a picture of her sitting on the grass, on the lawn, on the ground, with the net, and she's got balls, and she's laughing. And so one guy, a woman, who's a member here, has a picture of it. When I moved here last year with Tom, she went out of her way when she heard about it. She said, I think you were in a picture with Alice Marble. So that was my claim to fame, that I was pictured with Alice Marble. She was number one world's woman's player at the time. Went on to New York and probably won it for herself, I can't remember. So, but we both were in the Navy by this time. And in the Navy, we were regular pilots, and as a result, I could fly maybe once every 8 days.
And what kind of plane was it?
If you don't know planes, I flew an SBD, a Scout Bomber by Douglas, SBD. And Bill flew always, Sikorsky, Kingfisher, different plane. We were not together. You know, the Navy, you don't go where you want. You go where they'd say.
Right.
You sign up, and they put Bill on the carrier. And I was not on a carrier. I was always land-based. But luckily for me, I was sent to Panama. And in Panama, I played tennis about once every 8 days. And in one period of time, I was in Panama almost 2 years, I guess. And we had good courts, so I played on my day off. Like once I raised it. But one day I got a phone call from a guy on the other side of the canal. It's Panama spread out. I'm on the Atlantic side, and there's a Pacific side. And I got a call from somebody on the Pacific side. Happened to be the Notre Dame's tennis number one man when I was in college. And he knew of me and Bill. As a matter of fact, his job was an athletic job on the Lake in Panama to provide physical fitness stuff, a sports program. And he says, "Hey, Murphy," I remember who he was. He said, "You ever play with Alice Marble?" She's the world's best woman. "Ever play Alice?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, you got a chance to." The USTA had arranged for Alice Marble and the British girl, the number two best woman in the world, Mary something. So they were on a goodwill tour, stopping off to play. And this guy, the Notre Dame guy, has arranged for them to stop and play. So then he called me and asked if I could find a player and play her at a big exhibition. And I did. I did. One of the guys I was playing with every eighth day, he and I played. Mary Hardick was her name. Mary Hardick and Alice Marble. Now, they're the two best players in the world. Europe was at war, so there were not a lot of people, see. And that's when she fell down a little, so I laughed in, and then the Admiral had us for dinner, and we danced and stuff. And that's when the Admiral asked me, "Hey, what are you going to do after the war, Murphy?" First of all, it was a great picture in what was in American Lawn Tennis Magazine of her, and the picture of a high up shot down below the tennis court, and nice little bleacher, all sailors, front row, all admirals and stuff. And behind it, some water, you know, it was the part of the canal. And that night, he had us dinner, too. And he said to me, "Oh, I forgot to tell you that. When I played every eighth day, the admiral was out there about every fifth day. You know, at his time, see. And if time... it was such that we were there at the same time. I was always his doubles partner because I happened to be the best player in the canal zone.
Right.
That's all. So one day at dinner, he said, "Murphy, what are you going to do after the war?" I said, "I want to be a coach." "A coach? Here is the gentleman. I'm dining with the Admiral of the Atlantic Fleet." He said, "A coach, what are you going to do?" I said, "I want to coach basketball and tennis." He said, "Oh, you'll be making a mistake." He said, "Murphy, if you stay in the Navy, you'll spend the rest of your career playing doubles with admirals." I said, "No, I don't want to do it. Spend the rest of your career playing doubles with admirals." And then so that passed, that event passed. But then came the time, maybe weeks later, when the submarine scare in the canal was over, so they're sending us to different places. Mm-hmm. And he knew that I was being transferred somewhere. So he said to me, he said, "Murphy, come to dinner, will you?" He sent his driver over in the station wagon with his admiral's flag, say, "Murphy, the admiral wants you for dinner tonight at his place." So I went to dinner, and that's when after dinner we're drinking, sitting around in his room having a drink, and he said, "Murphy, where are you going?" "What do you mean? Where are you going now?" I mean, "Where am I being transferred?" And I thought, "What the hell? He knows where I'm being transferred, so I don't. And I know I'm going where they're telling me to go." See, I said, "Well, how did this happen?" I see. "Oh," he said, "Can you fly an SNJ?" I said, "No, SNJ." Anyway, essentially, as it's kind of an airplane, a float airplane, his airplane.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "No, sir." He said, "You can." He said, "What the hell? Watkins can teach you. Watkins, can't you teach him? You can teach Murphy to fly an SNJ, couldn't you?" I said, "Oh." He said, "Don't you want to be his co-pilot? You know, he is the admiral's going to fly all over the territory, whatever the duties are. in his airplane. And he wanted me to be assigned to that.
So you'd be able to fly with him while over?
And play tennis.
Play tennis.
That's right. And I said, no, I don't. Nothing came of that. I got transferred somewhere else. And that's the end. But that's my experiences in tennis.
Was that the first, was that the time at which you thought you knew you wanted to be a coach? When did you first know you wanted to coach tennis?
Well, after I went to University of Chicago, graduated in 1939, the war was in 41.
Uh-huh.
In 39, then I went to grad school for 2 years. And that's when I wanted to be a coach. The grad school, George Williams College, was great for athletics.
So did you start coaching at George Williams College?
No, oh, no, no, no.
Where did you start?
Yeah, well, that's a good one. After the war, Bill and I both, see, I got my first job was University of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew people in University of Minnesota in order to coach. And my brother became coach at University of Michigan almost at the same time. And then I coached, make it short, I coached 3 years at Minnesota, and then I went to Cal Berkeley.
When you were at Minnesota and he was at Michigan, who won the most?
Well, he won. Barry McKay was the number one man.
Oh, wow, yeah.
He won the national title. Barry had a bad accident. No, not a bad accident. No one knows what happened to him. That's a little story. Anyway, so I went to Minnesota, and in 3 years, I transferred to Berkeley. Bill stayed at Michigan for a long time, long, long time. Won the Big Ten 6 years in a row or something.
Well, did you? So you moved. You went out to Cal Berkeley. Did you like that next move?
Yeah. Yeah. I did. I was not married. I liked it. We didn't have our playing conditions were far from ideal. We couldn't get on the court on a weekend. I couldn't get a tennis court because it's soon. Wow. Well, the courts weren't for us, for our team.
Uh-huh.
The courts were there. Nice, about 12 courts. But I had no privileges. That was a minor trouble. I had a nice time at Berkeley. I liked it. I had a good doubles team.
Was tennis as popular in California at that point?
Oh, yeah.
Very popular.
USC, UCLA, and Stanford was. The McEnroes hadn't come to Stanford. While I was coaching the 3 years in Minnesota, the McEnroes came to Stanford. Then they became the Stanford tennis team, you know.
So you were you at Cal Berkeley when George Tolley was
the coach? Tolley was coaching at USC. Yeah.
At USC.
Yeah. Incidentally, I might digress a bit. When Bill and I were, I didn't mention. I skipped. Bill and I played the Eastern Grass Court Circuit 2 summers. The Eastern Grass Court Circuit was held about 6 weeks in the East. Grass. And one of our good wins, we beat Tolley and Gardner-Molloy.
Gardner-Molloy.
And Tolley, to this day, well, he passed away about 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He would say, "Hey, you guys, you're the reason Gardner-Molloy dropped me as a partner." Bill and I didn't remember. We didn't associate him. That's when Molloy took him. Billy's Halbert as his partner. George Tolley was totally passed away about 3 years ago.
Right. Yeah.
So that's how I became a coach. I just majored in PE at George Williams College. You didn't major in stuff like that at the University of Chicago.
So you had dual duties. You were teaching physical ed at the same time that you were coaching.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You wrote several books.
Yeah, so
stuff
like Tennis for Beginners.
Let me see if I've got these right. You wrote how to teach your child baseball, football, soccer, basketball, tennis, tumbling, and volleyball.
Yeah, let me tell you, I thought I was going to make some money on that. Think of the topic.
Everybody should buy it.
Yeah, geez. Boy, I didn't sell a damn thing. I didn't know the right people. And then I wrote, after inner tennis,
uh-huh.
I wrote Tennis for Thinking Players.
Tennis for Thinking Players.
Yeah, and that...
You wrote a book called Advanced Tennis,
mm-hmm.
A Parent's Guide to Teaching Kids
yeah,
to Play.
Yeah, that's right.
A Lifetime of Treasured Tennis Tips. You wrote, now, this the Ronald Sports Library Tennis for Beginners.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, did you write all the books with your brother?
No, some one or two we did. I can tell you the ones I wrote myself was Tennis for Teaching Players. That was, you know, that came out after Inner Game. You know, Inner Game was Don't Think. Do you know about that Inner Game?
What? Yeah, I did. I remember it.
Oh, you don't think, you know, it's relax.
Galloway's book.
Galloway's book, yeah. I couldn't think of his name, yeah. I got a lot of pieces of mail telling me, in these words, it's time somebody had a sensible approach to the game. Whoever thought of going out, not thinking when they're playing. I'm glad you got, Murphy, I'm glad you got some sense, you know, going. Really, I got it.
Well, there's one excerpt from one of your books that says, there's no irrefutable laws of learning, no hard and fast rules that tell us the best way to teach,
mm-hmm.
nor is there any simple explanation of how children learn best. Many variables occur in any learning situation that affect the degree of learning that occurs. I like that. Mm-hmm. I thought that was very good. You went on to say that there's several principles of learning. Do you remember some of the principles that you applied in it? Or what are your thoughts now? As you look back, the book's long since been written. Now you're sitting back, you look at, and you still...
Well, I always had my maxim was, telling isn't teaching. The learner learns by doing. Telling isn't teaching. It's not teaching. The learner learns by doing.
A friend of mine, Wayne Bryan.
Yeah, I know his name from something.
And his boys are the best double, the Bryan brothers.
Oh, those guys, yeah.
Yeah, his father is constantly saying, children take it in through their eyes. You can take them to a college tennis match, and they can see and learn more at a college tennis match than you and I could sit there and try to explain.
That's probably right. Probably.
That sort of fits with what you're saying in your book there.
When I said, because I always felt this. This is the broadest statement you've ever had anybody make. I'm saying, in the tennis world, nobody practices enough. I'm telling you, people just don't practice enough. And I'm saying, and so I say, telling with teaching, you got to do it. You got to do it. You got to do it. Oh, incidentally, maybe I'm digressing, but I got a book about secrets of Spanish tennis, why they have such a good program. And they're very much into it. You got to do it. You got to hit those balls. You got to hit 100 balls, 20 balls, 20 balls, 20 balls before you go to the next court, you know. Instead of getting out the horse there, honestly. Now, how did they get into that? I was telling you about all the books I was writing. And I said, talking isn't teaching. The learner has to be in action. That's for our sport.
Right. You, let me ask you this. Is there a difference, it seems that so much of what I see out there now lends itself more to entertainment. It could be just me just remembering something that never happened. So I'm going to ask you. I tend to romance about the idea that in your era there was a little bit more depth to what was going on. It was education before entertainment. Am I wrong?
Well, let me think about that. Entertainment. Well, of course, with they didn't have top level tennis on every hour of the day, as we do now. So there was entertainment, but I don't know.
How does the well?
It wasn't any by any means any never being as popular, you know.
Well, you played college tennis and you played the format. You just recently went to a new format. You went to Georgia Tech Georgia match.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you enjoy it?
Very much so, yeah, because I have been both my brother and I suffered by being out of the game totally as pilots. I didn't give two hoots in hell what was going on at Forest Hills or Flushing Meadows. I'm up at 10,000 feet.
Right.
And got back and I said, oh my God, they play so differently, you know. And then I found out that the training conditions were modernized, and I'm very pleased to know that tennis being taught the way it is. It's everybody and his uncle is a tennis pro now, and some are good. You know what I mean? And making a lot of good players.
You like the way it's being taught now?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Well, let me put this in. I did not know that there were so many tennis academies or camps, whatever they are. You know, Russ, what's his name, was the first notorious one. You know.
Bolter.
Yeah, Bolter, Nick Bolter, yeah.
Or Harry Hopman's.
Yeah, okay, I see, that's right. But now everybody does it, and they each have their star that they think is going to be the next star. Right. A good example is the girl that they thought was going to be maybe dethrone one of the Williams this year because she was good enough earlier in the season to have some good wins, but then she slipped a bit. And I just happened, the coach was, her coach was had a camp. And he had great hopes for her. And they all, you know, if you watch it enough, they show the match. Then they all put the camera on her team or his team sitting in the bleachers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the head coach, the heart coach, the other guys. And this girl, forgotten her last name, I told Tom, she might be the next woman player, but she slipped and at the moment she's about the fifth, you know. But still, everybody in his uncle's got a protege.
Yeah.
Which is good. I like that.
Well, they changed. You went to the NCAAs in Athens.
Yeah.
And you watched that. And then they've changed the format now where it's no ad scoring. Do you remember when no ad came in? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I did. I was not aware when it did. And I was there watching a match and I thought, what's going on here? And then I had to be so no ad scoring, they played that ball hit.
So the whole emphasis is to make it quicker, to go by quicker. If they can make it go by quicker,
that's the reason for it.
Then the fans would be there more. The they think they would get more fans that way.
Hmm.
What do you think about that?
Well, I wasn't aware that thought it was too long.
They think it's too long. They'd like to get it down a match. They'd like to see it finished under 3 hours.
Baseball is going for the same thing.
Yeah. You've seen other changes, though. There's a reluctance. Do you have any thoughts? Let me ask you this. Do you have any thoughts on the difference between no ad and ad tennis? I talked to a friend about another gentleman, Alan Fox.
Alan Fox, I'm making
Alan
a failure,
Fox,
yeah.
He said that no ad is a sprint, and ad is the mile.
And so what?
The mile. You know, what are your thoughts on no ad?
Yeah, I might say I like that. It happens too abruptly. You like to have the deuce ad battle, you know what I mean? Which you don't have now.
There's sort of many wars involved in that.
Yeah.
And there's
yeah.
drama. It sort of builds up, yeah. you know.
then but it drops off a cliff, you know. If they're playing deuce ad four times, there's a lot of drama on that too. But if it is not, just once, right?
Right. It's over. And yeah. Were you coaching when Noad was brought into college tennis?
No,
and you left coaching?
No. Yeah.
Where did you go after college coaching?
I went to the PE department at Berkeley. Coached there 11 years. Taught there 11 years. Mm-hmm. And retired. I retired, just totally.
And then what did you do?
Beg your pardon?
Then what did you do?
Then I just stayed this life. I started living in the Palm Desert. You know, I still live in Palm Desert. And I have two sons. Thomas adopted. Did you know that?
I didn't know.
Oh, yeah. Thomas, my adopted son. I adopted two boys. Tom, when he was 4, and Tony, when he was 2. Same time. I married a girl with that. See. And so I moved to, when I left Berkeley, and I stayed at Berkeley, but I was teaching in the different buildings and stuff. I just stayed in Berkeley until I moved to Tucson. I guess Bill, my brother, was teaching at Tucson, and
where was he in Tucson? Where were you guys located in Tucson?
Well, we were not together. Now he and his wife moved in the place, and I moved alone.
Do you remember the name of the club?
No, I didn't live. Didn't belong to the club.
Do you remember the name of where you taught? Do you know what it was like?
I didn't teach that.
You didn't teach that?
No, when I retired.
Okay, when were you, because it said that you taught for 44 years at the Bardmore in Colorado. Tell me about that.
Every summer.
When did you start that?
Well, that's a good story. You know, have you been to the Bardmore, seen the Bardmore?
I've seen it. I haven't been there.
It's a heavenly place. Bill and I, when we played, going back to when we were still in the University of Chicago playing, we were given equipment from Spalding.
Uh-huh.
Spalding had the biggest store in Chicago. And so we played as amateur players on Chicago's clay courts. And, you know, I got to the finals of the National Collegiate Tournament. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm.
And we did in doubles, too. And we were using Spalding equipment because that's part of the story. Back home in Chicago, the championship was played in the East. And when back home, I got back to Chicago, and the guy from Chicago, from the Spalding office, called me and talked me into applying for a job at this hotel somewhere, which I did. So I got somebody at the hotel, and that man, Mr. Tutt, T-U-T-T, one of the Tutt families who owned the place, said, I'm going to Chicago, let's stop and meet. Well, anyway, he hired me. He was on his way to Chicago from Colorado to New York. And he hired me and went to Broadmoor. Didn't own a car, took a train or a bus to the Broadmoor. And they gave me a room and board. No salaries to start with, but everything I make was mine. And we had 4 courts. And then eventually it grew. We never had more than 6 courts, but it was a great job.
You turned it into sort of a mecca. It became a very well-known.
We ran a tournament. We ran a Broadmoor Invitational Tournament. And it's only an hour's drive from Denver, see, the Broadmoor. So we got Denver's players to come down. I went up and scouted at Denver and recruited. I said, who's that? That's Smith and Jones. Geez, they're number 2 in the Rocky Mountains. So next year they were in our tournament. Pretty soon ours is the biggest tournament. You know, it's a professional outfit. And I had no problem. I was lucky enough to meet the right people.
Let me ask you your interaction. You had probably, did you get to see, tell me about your, with Tilden, Bill Tilden.
Oh, Bill's in my, I skipped that. Here we go back to Mr. Parkhill, and he's giving us lessons in the morning before school. Remember, we changed bathroom and everything else. And all day Saturday, he had the gym. We got the gym. It was a boys gym, enough for two basketball floors, so that's enough for two tennis courts. And we spent all day Saturday there. And finally, one day, the professional tour, sponsored by some outfit in Chicago, Bill Tilden and Hans Nusslein, Germany's best player, are on tour going one night after night. And they're going to play at in the Chicago Stadium.
Was that part of the barnstorming stuff that was going on?
Well, just one. He was the only guy. Bill Tilden was the only guy doing it. Along afterward came
Kramer.
Yeah, Kramer, right. All those people. But before, just Tilden alone. And Hans Nusslein. And two guys, as the preliminary, they play two matches, you know. Emmett Perret and Bruce Byrnes. Does that register with you?
Mm-hmm.
Emmett Perret from Tulane and Bruce Byrnes. They were the initial match. And after their match, Tilden would play this other guy. Until our coach, Mr. Parkhill, arranged for us, Bill, myself, and the other six or eight guys that were on our high school team then, to be ball boys at Bill Tilden. The first organized tennis match we saw, we ball boys for Bill Tilden in the stadium. And after the stadium...
Can you remember about how old he would have been then?
Oh, I wouldn't know. I don't know.
And, was he past his prime, or was he in his prime?
No, he was. Well, he was good enough to be the centerpiece in this weekend affair. But I guess my memory is so bad I can't tell you who the other players were. But he had some others who were equal to his skill. I remember once when the first night we went, it was snowing in Chicago. And we got in, our coach took us in his car. We packed in the car. And we got to the Chicago Stadium where it was being played. And as we walked in the front door, it was an armory. You know, a military armory where the military trained. They arranged to have a tennis match there. And as we walked in the door, he saw us. And he was like, hey, boys, this way, boys. So that was my association. He came to practice Saturday morning. Now, this was all Saturday night. But that morning, he came to Bill Tilden because he was Spalding, too. Spalding helped promote the whole thing. And he came to practice, and Bill and I and just four other guys were rattling. We had two courts, and we were rattling back and forth. And I remember he's got a... Coat this color rain is because it's snowing like him. So, and he comes into the clubhouse, and he goes from player to player to player. Spends a few minutes. We're rallying, see. And I remember he came to me, and I have them. I still do. I hold the racket with my thumb up the handle. You know. See this back?
Right.
He comes to me. Came to me, and he. Put your thumb around, Simon. I think I hit two balls and I put it back. See? So he corrected me three or four times, and finally he said, Parkhill, he said, all right, what do you got this boy with his thumb up the handle for? Get him out of there, you know. Because he wanted to hold it.
Right.
And I still hold it that way. And our coach, Bill Parkhill, said, I'll get this. What's wrong with that? Helen Wills Moody holds it that way. To goodness.
Oh, my goodness. You did you see Bugs play?
Time and time again, yeah, but never spoke so friendly. We were not friends. We were. He was not in our group, nor were he in his. You know, he's.
Kramer, did you watch
Kramer? We're good. My brother and I are good friends. In fact, we had one of my first things at the Broadmoor was to arrange a weekend Sunday morning or Sunday exhibition. Jack Kramer and his doubles partner, Jesus, I can't think of, came. We the Broadmoor brought them out.
Right.
And Bill and I played them. Crawford played Kramer and Miss Shorter. First name. Anyway, a doubles match. And they brought their families and
right.
Spent 2 or 3 days. You know. Kramer was a very congenial, nice, he really a nice guy.
He was with Wilson, not Spalding.
Yeah, Wilson. He was Wilson. Mm-hmm. Oh.
You got to see Gonzalez play?
Well, Gonzalez never said two words to him. Even to this day, I've never said two words. Our paths never crossed. But he was the throne, on the throne then. He was the best player in the world then. But he had.
But you got to see him play. Did he ever come
time
out to the Barmore?
No.
What players did you have out at the Barmore?
That's all. That's all. Billy Talbot stopped in and played when he was renowned as a doubles player. And then all the rankings, Denver and Salt Lake, we got players, but no world-class players.
So of the players that you got to see and perhaps play against throughout the years, who ranks as somebody, and include today, if you watch television today and you watch tennis today,
yeah.
Who do you find to be the most impressive to you?
Well, I think Kramer, as his best, was tough with his serve and volley. Big serve, and nice guy. Really a nice guy. And Vines, we saw Vines play. And Budge, just saw Budge play several times, but never rubbed elbows with, never in the same spot. You know. We were not good enough to be that guy. Bill and I were never world ranking players.
Mm-hmm.
We quit too early. I mean, we quit in the middle. We just grabbed no know how to play the game, and the war came on. Well, first before we went to the Army, to the Navy, we both worked at a summer camp in Wisconsin, not a tennis camp, a Northwoods camp, you know. Because that's going to be our profession, be a woodsy guy. So we were out of tennis. And when I came back, it was quite a lot different. A lot had happened. So maybe a few camps were built. No, that's the only guy going, and we've already mentioned his name. The first guy with the big camp.
Hopman, Harry Hopman, volunteer.
No.
Nick
Bolicieri. Yeah, Bolicieri. My brother worked at a club that Bill, he relieved Bill Terry at a club in Chicago. Bolicieri, when he organized his own camp, he had been working at a club in Chicago. And he left to move to Florida with his club. And that was the era of that. Kinds of things, and I think Bill Terry might have been the first. I'm not sure. He might have been the first camp, but who knows? It may have been a lot of them.
I'm trying to think. I'm not sure if Hopman's was. Maybe Hopman was in New York. Remember
he was in.
I think Port Washington.
Oh yeah, I remember. Yeah.
I'm trying to think.
Yeah, before the Mekin was discovered.
And then you had John Gardner's tennis ranch.
Oh yeah, John Gardner's ranch.
Margaret Court, I think.
Pardon me?
Margaret Court would come out to Tucson. Was it Margaret Court?
I know of her, but I've never, I wasn't at Tucson. No, Gardner and I were good friends, very good friends.
You and John Gardner were good friends?
Very good friends.
So you were impressed with, if you even including Federer and at all, you were impressed with Kramer quite a bit.
Well, every one of them, I was impressed by every one of them. I suppose the little lefty, Australian lefty.
Labor,
yeah. Labor, you got to give Labor credit for a record, too, you know.
Did you have any interaction with Labor in exhibition
No,
was,
that's a different era. See, remember, my brother and I, in effect, dropped out of tennis when we started working at a camp and going to graduate school. No more tennis.
But you were writing books about tennis, and you were still running Broadmoor, right?
Well, I got a job at, the Broadmoor was the only connection I had, yeah. I shouldn't have said we were, and I was teaching at the University of Chicago, too, after I graduated in 39. But I spent 1 year teaching high school.
When did you stop teaching tennis?
Well, I taught for 11 years at Berkeley. And then I went to the other department, to the PE department. And that's just because they wanted me to offer me this amount of money to teach this with no recruiting, I accept. No, recruiting amounts to nothing. Jesus, terrible.
Right.
I didn't want any of that. And I thought, boy, I'm teaching this kind of tennis and sports. I made myself a self-styled specialist in biomechanics, biomechanics. I taught biomechanics courses in sports, not tennis, sports. I have for PE majors, men and women, see, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It was good stuff.
Okay, that's the first part of my interview with Chet Murphy. I'll try to get the second half of this interview up as soon as I can. For a guy like me, this is fun stuff, getting to interview a gentleman like him who's seen it all over the years. And I hope you'll tune in and listen to this interview, and then hopefully the subsequent interview will attract you as well. So I look forward to hearing from everyone. Any feedback you can give me. And also, if you know of anybody else that's out there who left their mark in coaching tennis, please try to get in touch with me and let me know about them, and I'll try to get an interview with them.
This has been the We Coach Tennis Radio Show on the Yellow Ball Network. Check in here with us every Tuesday at noon and listen to another great coach talk about what makes their program a success.